This is Melissa. It is the 7th of June, 2026, and I hope that you're all doing well. You may recall that I have mentioned to you before a gentleman in England named Stuart, and Stuart, for the CTTM Book Club, starting on Telegram and continuing on, has kindly taken it upon himself to clean up many, many audios of Alan Watts. He cleaned up many interviews that Alan did with Jackie Petru and on her show Sweet Liberty. And it's a really wonderful thing that he's doing. I hope at some point that I can make these available to you. So he sent me a disc with a bunch that he had done around Christmas time, and I'm still collecting them, and we'll put them out when I can. But I'd mentioned to him that I had been listening to Alan on talking to somebody who went by the name of Visigoth, and that was Keith Hansen on a show called From the Grassy Knoll. So it's my understanding that Visigoth Hansen passed away about a year and a half ago now. And he had a different conclusion as to who was behind everything, and he came down hard on Jesuits in the Vatican, etc. That was not Alan's conclusion, but they always had good conversations. And so the one that I'm sharing with you today is part one of a three-part series that they did called The System. And I am going to play these cleaned up audios for you over the next 3 weeks, or today in the next 2 weeks. And you're welcome, of course, to jump ahead if you want to listen to them, but just know that what I put up will be cleaned up audios, and it's helpful to have that. So they have a good discussion about money, the con of money. They get into Freemasonry a little bit. Alan talks about his books, the Cutting Through books. There were just a couple of things that I cut out of the audio simply because they spent several minutes at two different places discussing how you could send a check to Alan in Canada. And, you know, so I just didn't want to spend the time on repeating the address. There's something about talking about Freemasonry. Someone published an email exchange I had with them, or part of an email exchange. So I think it's okay if I quote the published bit here. We're discussing a person, and I had mentioned that this person was alleged to have been a Freemason and to have also been in the OTO. And the person that I was corresponding with said, so he wrote about this person that we were discussing. Freemasonry, yes, he joined. But the idea that Freemasonry is a single thing that can be equated with evil machinations is second matrix dumbing down that, in my opinion, does more harm than good. Now, I would disagree with that. I think that secret societies that have an agenda to reshape things to suit their own vision of the world, in which people are initiated and sworn to secrecy, I can't help but think that that is always going to come to no good. And I think that if you really study the history of Freemasonry, and you can study it from their own writing, where they're putting the best spin on it that they possibly can. And if you can see what you're reading, then you may well conclude, as Alan did, as I do, that you are looking at evil machinations. Now, in Book Club, I came up with the idea that we would next cover Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma. And I'm really enjoying this so far. I I've heard from other people that are excited to launch into it, that have started reading it. I've heard from a few others that aren't keen on covering this book, and they want to wait and get into Alan's books. But I actually think that this is going to be a really good foundation, if I'm going to use Freemasonic terminology, a good foundation for understanding Alan's conclusions about the way the world works. And I've just finished the third degree in morals and dogma. What I find fascinating is that, you see, Pike is writing the, you know, it's for the initiate, for the first one is the apprentice. That's the first degree. And you can see very cleverly that the mind of the initiate is being bent, constantly being bent. Here, this is on page 5. They're talking about the rough and the perfect Ashlar. The rough Ashlar and the perfect Ashlar are the jewels of the lodge. The rough Ashlar is said to be a stone that is taken from the quarry in its rude and natural state, and the perfect Ashlar is said to be a stone made ready by the hands of the workman to be adjusted by the working tools of the fellow craft. We shall not repeat the explanations of these symbols given by the York Rite. You may read them in its printed monitors. They are declared to allude to the self-improvement of the individual craftsman, a continuation of the same superficial interpretation. The rough Ashlar is the people as a mass, rude and unorganized. The perfect Ashlar, or cubical stone, symbol of perfection, is the state, the rulers deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. Remember that. You have to give consent to this. Because I have the great privilege of reading Alan's copy of Morals and Dogma, I have the opportunity to see where he's made notes and where he's underlined. But as I pointed out to the people in book club, at the very beginning of his volume, it says here that the book is the property of John D. Walters. And then there's a fall class reunion, November 18, 1946, and a bunch of people have signed it. Now, this afternoon, just for curiosity, I looked below the property of John D. Walters. I looked at the names. I'd have to take a magnifying glass or some kind of jeweler's loop to make out a lot of these names. But John D. Walters appeared to be a 32nd degree Freemason who passed away about 10 years ago. And it is signed by a couple of dozen people who give their, ranging from, there's a one person here at the 14th degree, but most, almost all, were 32nd degree and a couple of 33rd degree Masons. And I wasn't able to come up with anything on any of them except possibly one. And that made me think there, because these are apprentices of the fellow craft. And they are in your town. If you drive into your town, I don't know how it is in Europe, but in any Canadian town or American town or city, it's the you'll see the signs of all of the different Masonic organizations who welcome you to their city. And once you reach that 32nd degree of your local lodge, then you can start to communicate in a big way with people in other lodges. So the degrees take you up the ladder if you want to look at the square. And the compass takes you into these circles. And circles that, you know, interlock with each other or overcross each other. And so circles within circles, or overlapping circles of connections and relationships. And you will see very clearly as you get into morals and dogma that there is, and this was written in 1871, there is an agenda to reshape society. And Pike says, this is not a religion. All religions are welcome. But the doublethink comes in right away, because all religions are welcome. And so if it's a Jewish lodge, you're going to have Torah there. If it's a Christian lodge, you'll have the Christian Bible. If it's a Muslim lodge, then you will have the Quran there. So what he stresses is that the writings, the tradition of Freemasonry supersedes all of these traditions. And then he goes, you know, he says, you must have your religion. That's very important. But then he begins to undermine that religion right away to show, you know, how religions, he's particularly hard on the papacy, but he, you know, no Protestant is left unsullied. It's a system. But Pike says right off the bat, you know, they had a hand in the French Revolution and they're proud of it. Well, we're still living through the very bad effects of the French Revolution. That would be a conversation for another time. But if you've started it, I hope that you're finding it interesting. So far in a, you know, this is a real nutshell, but the first degree is The Apprentice, and this is, he's just showing you the basics, what it is to ascend a ladder, the rungs of the ladders, the degrees, and then he shows you there's degrees, there's planets, you've got the compass, the square, the sun, the moon. The second degree is the fellowcraft, and that's Masonry. He says Masonry is a march and a struggle toward the light. So whenever you see that word light, you can substitute Lucifer, if you like, and you can see things from a different angle. But I want to read you something here on page 38 of the second degree, because I want to contrast this to Alan. He's basically telling you how everything, all of the religions, all of the philosophies and thoughts had something that was right for their time. Okay, so right away they show you their disdain for the common man. The popular explanations of the symbols of Masonry are fitting for the multitude that have swarmed into the temples, being fully up to the level of their capacity. Catholicism was a vital truth in its earliest ages, but it became obsolete, and Protestantism arose, flourished, and deteriorated. This is 1871. The doctrines of Zoroaster were the best which the ancient Persians were fitted to receive. Those of Confucius were fitted for the Chinese. Those of Muhammad for the idolatrous Arabs of his age. Each was truth for the time. Each was a gospel preached by a reformer, and if any men are so little fortunate as to remain content therewith when others have attained a higher truth, it is their misfortune and not their fault. They are to be pitied for it and not persecuted. Each was truth for a time. And he goes on to write about that everything is for its time, and that truth is basically relative to the time. Now, here is what I wanted to share on the last page of the first volume of Alan Watt's book, Cutting Through, Volume 1. The man in rags who speaks pure wisdom is ignored in the West. Trained to respect success, The masses follow media messiahs who travel in Lear jets, the messianic mafia, master masons, the prophets of profit. I just want to say here that speaking of media messiahs who travel in Lear jets, I saw that Candace Owens was the belle of the ball in Russia, where they had a gathering there at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Now, this was called, the Russian Davos or Putin's Davos at one point. But, since the war with Ukraine, Russia has thousands of sanctions levied against it. But Candace Owens showed up along with Steven Seagal, of all people, who evidently is a good buddy with Putin. And she had things to say. But Candace Owens is a media messiah who travels in a Learjet, right? We are drowning in these kinds of people. We are drowning in people that we hold up to be our heroes, or who speak truth to power, or who have something to say about the changing of the guard, or our new multipolar world that we're going into. This is, when I look, as I've said before recently, and I'll probably continue to comment on, but when I look at what comes into my inbox day in and day out, and then I do the scan and try to get the bird's eye view and say what is important, what I know for sure is that I'm looking at technique. I'm looking at technique that you could well call overwhelm. So Alan went on to write here, "Sheep are fleeced, they are mut on. The earliest priests of Sumer wore sheepskin loincloths, lions in sheep's clothing. Mason's aprons are made of wool. Persian Sufis, now Mohammedan Sufis, derived their name from their wool covering. They are the mystic sect leading Mohammedans to the same point within a circle. A similar sect, Hasidic rabbis, lead Jews into the same enclosure. Each flock follows their master, thinking birthplace and culture has reserved a place in paradise. This work is for the individual spirit, for those who know that this universe and this world was made by something greater and more wonderful than human minds could ever dream of." Okay, and he continues on. It's beautiful there what he writes. But what he's writing about, as he said to Keith Hansen, is the system of Freemasonry. This is unmerited favor. It's in every small town, and it branches out from there. Unmerited favor, and we are taught to worship it. So the third degree is called the master, and it focuses on words. The second degree concentrated a lot on numbers, how to see what we, how they play with numbers. And that's very interesting to see, and you get more numbers in the third degree, but also words. So numbers and combinations of numbers and how words are played with. So I can't think of basically Alan's life's work as being second matrix dumbing down. I think he's worked his way back through history with a gathering of knowledge and insights into the dusty old books that he read that are unequaled by anyone that I've ever come across, and really do help give us the bird's eye view. So I'll be posting more about the reading schedule. One thing I'm going to give you right now is, or tonight, is a couple of good online versions of the book. There is one on Internet Archive, which is great. It's got the same page count as the book that I'm reading from, but it is missing the index. But I think it's very important for the flow of our discussions in book club. If you're reading the same page, it's just too difficult, especially for a book of this size, for us not to be able to know what page we're on. Now, I found one at a site called sacredtexts.com. And this one does give you a page by page. You have to click on each one. There's probably some clever way of downloading it or getting it all. But for instance, when I click on The Apprentice, it's going to tell you in a small number there that you are on page 3. And that this matches up all the way from page 1 to page 861. You're exactly where I am in my book. And this particular one also has the added benefit of the index as well. And not to overwhelm, but I have taken it on for my own reading education to read something that evidently Albert Mackay was working on at the time of his death called The History of Freemasonry. If you are Scottish, I guess you say Mackay, and I think other people looking at that name might say Albert Mackey. But this is also an older volume. It superseded or replaced Morals and Dogma. I'm finding this to be very interesting to dive into this study of Freemasonry a little more deeply. So I hope you enjoy if you've decided that you want to do this book with us, I hope that you're enjoying it. So just a couple of things that I'll mention really quickly before I move on. And what I don't want to do is overwhelm, because what I look at now, everywhere I look, I see the volume and intensity with which writers and talkers do deep, deep dives into things that I question if it is that important for us to know about in such detail. That's all I'm going to say. I think that there's a lot of mudslinging, a lot of calling people out for being controlled opposition, for being mouthpieces. I just said that Candace Owens was, a media mouthpiece traveling on a Learjet, or whatever, but I mean, come on, really, come on. My point is, I don't think, I hold you all in high regard. I think you're smart, and you can think for yourselves. And so I don't need to tell you all the time who to watch out for, right? Okay, so I mentioned spife or spief or however they say that. This is one that, happens every year, and for 30 years, I guess, 29 years. It is the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, an annual Russian business and economic event held in St. Petersburg since 1997. And this year, which just concluded yesterday, I guess, was called Pragmatic Dialogue, The Path to a Stable Future. There were 20,000 delegates from 130 countries. The forum highlights Russia's pivot toward the global south, BRICS nations, and the Middle East, reflecting a consolidation of partnerships amid extensive Western sanctions. Saudi Arabia was the guest of honor, marking the 100th anniversary of diplomatic relations. And what's interesting is that even though there are all these intense sanctions on Russia by the U.S., there were all kinds of U.S. businesses that were there. So go figure how it really works. I guess they're, brothers with special handshakes. Now, there is something, I saw this from a Substack writer who went into great detail, but I will link to her original article here because it was because of her article that I learned that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump had purchased an abandoned island called Sazen. And I'll link to her article. I don't have it up in front of me at the moment, but I am looking at the moment at an article from The Independent, the UK newspaper. Inside Sazen Island, the Albanian ex-military base bought by Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner with 3,500 bunkers and tunnels. One of the reasons why the story jumped out at me in the first place is because I had been listening to Alan talking with Visigoth in this episode, and they taught, you know, Alan's talking about the secret brotherhoods and how they basically go to ground. They wait it out. Whatever the catastrophe is, they wait through it. And he and Visigoth are discussing the idea that, yeah, absolutely, the underground, literally the underground system seems to be such an important component of this. So with that in mind, when I saw 3,500 bunkers and tunnels, I had to look into it. The Trumps are facing protests over their billion-dollar plans for the island. Clearing has already begun on an area environmentalists say is key to conservation. Okay, so they paid $1.4 billion to purchase an abandoned island, a communist-era military base. The couple's deal also includes a $4.7 billion agreement on part of a protected coastal landscape in Zvernik, so a different region. So, two purchases. Albania's government has championed the Adriatic Coast development as a transformative venture for the nation, aiming to boost its high-end tourism sector and support its bid for European Union membership. But the project on the lush island and stretch of seafront on Albania's southern coast, referred to by Trump as a fixer-upper, has sparked criticism from environmental groups and detractors of the long-serving socialist prime minister, Edi Rama. Okay, now, President Trump's daughter says she and her husband discovered the area while on a hike. We were on a friend's boat, and we stopped for a swim. Effectively, that's how we found it. Now, who would say a sentence like that? Effectively, that's how we found it. Okay? Well, I don't know. I don't think I would say that. We stopped for a swim. Effectively, that's how we found it. We swam to the island. We went on a hike barefoot all the way up to the top, and we were just captivated. Okay, it's because I had read the other Substack article that I knew that the friend's boat they were on just happened to belong to Nat Rothschild. So now here I'm going to post another article from Forbes as well. I don't know that Forbes actually says that they were on a boat with Nat Rothschild, but it's very, very funny here to me. Oh yeah, this one does. Forbes says, yep, they stopped where they were on a yacht owned by Nat Rothschild, a one-time billionaire and part of the broader Rothschild family. Okay. All right. So just an interesting little, you know, why are they doing that? On a more serious note, I think, is that Canada's Senate has passed an anti-Christian, this is from LifeSite News, anti-Christian Bible ban, Bill C-9. And I'm going to give you this from LifeSite magazine. I'm also going to link to a letter that the, is it Cardinal? Who is it? Frank Cardinal Leo, the Metropolitan Archbishop of Toronto, wrote to the senators asking them strongly to consider serious refinements to this bill before passing it, saying that there are ways to address the concerns that are in the bill without being a threat to religious liberty. So back to the LifeSite article. Radical Bill C-9 now goes back to Canada's House of Commons, which already passed it in March, for a final vote on amendments before becoming law. Canadian senators voted to approve Liberals' Bill C-9, which, once it officially becomes law, will repeal religious protections and effectively criminalize quoting parts of the Bible, including on homosexuality. On Thursday evening, senators voted 45-13 to approve Bill C-9, or an act to amend the Criminal Code, Hate Propaganda, Hate Crime, and Access to Religious or Cultural Places. There were 2 abstentions, and 35 senators were not even on site to vote on the bill. Well, frankly, if they were my senator and I voted and did that, I would be annoyed, to say the least. As Bill C-9 was passed with amendments, it must now go back to the House of Commons, which must approve the amendments before it becomes law and then gets royal assent. Last-minute amendments to the bill proposed by some conservative senators that would have addressed concerns by many faith groups were rejected. Campaign Life Coalition blasted the passage of Bill C-9, saying, "God will not be mocked. This is a dark day for religious freedom and free speech in Canada." The passage of this deeply troubling legislation, however, will not stop us from speaking the Word of God, even when biblical truths are increasingly being labeled as hateful by those who are hostile to Christianity. God will not be mocked. We will continue to proclaim His Word. Now, let me just say something right here for people who are listening who are not religious at all. This is not just about religious liberty. This is about freedom of speech. And the one thing that seems like you're pushing Christianity down somebody's throat, or that one thing that you say that seems to be anti-Semitism, the bill is so vague, and yes, I did read through it. It is so vague that just about anything that comes out of your mouth could be construed as hate. One last thing on Freemasonry and morals and dogma. I was looking through the names that were written in pen and pencil in Alan's copy that he got secondhand from somewhere. One thing led to another, and I came up with the name Ted Barry. Ted Barry Sr. was Theodore M. Barry, and he was a Freemason. And this is an interesting thing. When you start to look into it, you see nobody has to declare there that they are initiated into a secret brotherhood. These records are kept at the local lodge level, and they're not, they don't need to be shared publicly. You can ask your congressperson or your senator or your parliamentarian, your minister, if they belong to a secret brotherhood. They don't have to tell you. But Theodore M. Barry, he was the youngest president of the Cincinnati NAACP, the first African-American mayor of Cincinnati, and he led a controversial campaign to create a city income tax. In this position, he was noticed by Sergeant Shriver, who's connected to the Kennedys via marriage. And it was because of the connection from Sergeant Shriver that President Lyndon Johnson appointed Ted Barry to head the Office of Economic Opportunity. This included Head Start, Job Corps, Legal Services, all of these programs that are still on the go. Barry was also good friends with Thurgood Marshall, who was the last Mason, as far as we know, to serve as Supreme Court Justice, and also the first African American. His son, Ted Barry Jr., has been convicted of some kind of sex crime, sexting, texting, whatever, you know, sex images. I'm not exactly sure. But I did notice that he had gotten off with basically a not much more than a slap on the wrist, because it's a brotherhood, unmerited favor. And I looked up to see what senators and congressmen are Masons. And again, they don't have to tell you. Many don't disclose that. But I saw a good old Republican from, I think it's Iowa, Senator Chuck Grassley. He's been a senator since 1981. He's 92 years old. So chances are that a lot of the people who passed Bill C-9 in Canada belong to some secret brotherhood. You see, if you, I'm looking, this is ancient history now. This is back in the 60s and the 70s here with Ted Berry Sr. But his work just brought him up and up the ladder, so to speak. What is happening with these brotherhoods, and it's not just Masons, we could spend, you know, hours and days talking about Skull and Bones, you know, these brotherhoods go on forever. But what is happening is that people who have an agenda, which is to beat that rough ashlar, that's you, that's me, we're the mass, we're the stupid sheep who have to be fleeced. We're the rough ashlar who have to be pounded and whittled into something that they approve of for their plans. So, yeah, like I say, I don't see this as so Dan Brown. Oh, it's, you know, this is so Da Vinci Code from 2.5 decades ago. This is so National Treasure, you know. It's very real. Trying to bring big picture, and I think that that's what Alan does very well here in this first of the three parts with Visigoth, is to give us the bird's eye view of a very old system. I appreciate your support. You can order books and discs and flash drives from me by Cash App if you are in the U.S. You can use Stripe from anywhere. If you're overseas, if you're in the U.S., you can also send a personal check. You can send that to CTTM, Post Office Box 815, Keene, K-E-E-N-E, Texas 76059. And I again, as I say, I do very much appreciate your support. I need it, and I thank you. Take care.
Welcome to the Grassy Knoll for yet another segment, the movable feast that is known as the Grassy Knoll. This is Viz, and with us today we have Alan Watt. Now, Alan is somebody who you might have heard on as a frequent guest on Jackie Betrue's Sweet Liberty. There is a listener to this show and that show out in Manitoba, a very sweet lady by the name of Lady O, who said in an email, you might want to check this gentleman out. And I did, and she was right. And I'm glad that he's with us today. From once again, the Great White North, we have a guest, and that is Alan Watt. And Alan, thanks for visiting the Grassy Knoll.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of hard to define exactly who you are. Yeah. And I'm going to do two things. One is I'm going to ask you an ice-breaking question, okay? Uh-huh. And I just want your take on it cold, and then we'll go into how you came about on the information that you have and the work that you've done. Mm-hmm. Do you have any original take on this shooting of a citizen down in Miami's airport.
Miami.
Yeah, are you familiar with what happened there?
I wasn't, no.
Okay. Well, there was a gentleman apparently who is bipolar, had come in from a flight from Colombia, South America, and supposedly wasn't on his medication and flipped out after the plane touched down on its arrival in Miami. Subsequently, an air marshal shot him dead. Then they took the luggage out of the plane, spread it over the tarmac down in Miami, had bombs, sniffing dogs, check them all out, blew up some luggage and found no explosives. So, I mean, I'm just throwing that out because you know how you hear these stories.
Yeah.
And is that first take and what really is going on. And I just didn't know if you looked into that and whether or not it had affected you in any way, shape, or form.
No. I mean, it's not unexpected because, in fact, it's to be expected now as they really beef up the security side. And the guys are getting trigger happy too, you know. So I'm not surprised at all. They had this whole deal in London airports for since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the public there are now used to armored vehicles even patrolling inside the airport and special police units and the black outfits and so on.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, this is not really to be unexpected. It's only increasing the fact, obviously.
You know, this may be just one of those organic occurrences. It just might be. I mean, we're all suspicious and speculative, and for good reason. But in this case, it may say more about people and pharmaceuticals than it does about any kind of show of force by the air marshals or the military or whatever. Be that as it may, I just want to throw that out there. But, Alan, I'm always curious, especially about people I've not really got a lot of information about,
yeah,
as to their experiences and, as you know, with regard to their first look down the rabbit hole.
Uh-huh.
When did you start to realize that the world that we live in is very much a matrix around which there is the real world?
I always tell people, and I'm not kidding, I think I was born that way, because I saw two realities coexisting simultaneously from really the beginning. And the first taste of it I got was, this is in Scotland, of course, was simply walking in and out of friends' homes. And when you're a youngster, you can do that and ignore you, you know, you carry on as normal. And every home I went into, everyone was arguing about the same things, which was to do with, at that time it was rent money and money for food. It wasn't for extras in those days. And yet I thought, well, how old is this system? Even then I asked those questions. And I thought, if Britain had an empire, how come I don't see anybody with the fruits of this empire? They all lived in London, which to me was a foreign, you know, country at that time. It was so far away. And of course, the more I studied, once I got into school and had access to the libraries, and then I had excellent, reference libraries too from old towns there with very old books, I realized that they were indeed changing history as time went on, and they were rubbing out the truth with every publication of updated history books. And yet you could go into the reference libraries in Scotland and look over books written in the 1700s and get the real stuff that was happening at the time.
Well, you make an excellent point, because I've been the beneficiary of seeing information like that in the United States, and I think you're probably you were probably more endowed with that sort of thing and more freely accessible to it over there than here.
Yeah.
But yes, the books of antiquity, the statements that are made in the past are very much, as they say, is prologue to the future, and in a lot of cases. And I think a lot of the luminaries were really in Great Britain at the time, or the United Kingdom, who had this plan. At least part of them showed it to us. And of course, I'm talking about Rhodes and Milner's kindergarten.
Yeah.
They were very, very vocal about what they wanted, and they thought it the greatest thing.
Yeah.
This was not, I don't think, as prevalent over here in the United States, especially contemporaneously. Later on now, you know, and I'll talk to you about Carol Quigley later on, but your remark about going back in and taking the looks, you know, at the information there, the writings of these elitist hands that said, this is what we're going to do, and they're doing it.
Yes, oh yeah. That's the astounding thing, is that they did write about it right up openly up until the early 1900s, because primarily those types of groups were only read by each other, themselves, their own peer group. And so they had nothing to worry about the masses or the working people. So they were quite open about where they were going. You know?
When I tell people that the plan has been pretty much exposed from time to time, sometimes with a laugh down the sleeve, many times overtly, as we see with H.G. Wells and others, even George Bernard Shaw.
Yeah.
And they said, well, why would they do that? Now, maybe you've had that question posed to you. Maybe it's not an important question, but to these people who do not want to go where you're leading them and they realize you've got some hard information,
yeah,
how would you answer them about why they would do that?
It's a legality, I believe. I've come to the conclusion that these guys are so legal. It's also a high Masonic ritual where you must mock the victim. And in other words, you inform them, and it's not your fault. They don't quite understand what you mean, or they might think you mean something else, or they're going to denial. But illegally, they have told you where you're going. And I've noticed this over and over again. They always announce it somewhere.
Interesting you should say that. Are you familiar with Rebecca Carly?
I've heard the name, yeah.
Well, she started a whole thing. We had an interview years ago. And she said to us, if you want to know where things are going, all you have to do is watch the Sci-Fi Channel in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And she said something to the effect, and it's on my website, because this spurred off a bit of an international gathering of pre-9/11 overt symbology in movies and in, you know, some Murdoch/Fox presentations, mm-hmm, like the Lone Gunman, and believe it or not, The Simpsons.
Yeah.
So she said, in their sick Masonic minds or in their sick Masonic code, if they tell you what they're going to do before they do it, it makes it okay. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I'd say that the lower Masons haven't a clue either, because Albert Pike said that they're no different from
That's
the
right.
general public. But the higher Masons definitely do. They talk in code. Yeah.
I just did an article for a paper, and I put them up on the website, Visigoth.com, mm-hmm, under Z-Files. And I did one today on a high degree Freemasonry, and it's in fact in the United States necessarily, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm only going to get hate mail from the Blue Lodge guys,
mm-hmm,
even though I did try to stipulate that the Blue Lodge has no idea, and you're right, Pike stated it, Morals and Dogma and elsewhere, that they are porch members who are meant to be kept in the dark.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And I want to do, if we could, an hour sometime on just this whole Masonry / Egyptian sun god worship / Mystery,
yeah,
Babylon religion thing in another show.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to what we had spoken about what it all comes down to. I mean, I think that this one world effort is partly spiritual, partly political, and partly economic.
Yeah.
And I think we all agree now that it all comes down to economics.
Yeah.
And so let me state that to you. Do you believe that what we're going to is what had been wanted since, you know, maybe five centuries ago?
Even longer. Uh-huh.
All right. Can you tell, is it really to you a primarily economic system that they want to implement
yes,
globally?
Yeah.
How far back does it go, though, Alan?
Well, there's the great work, they call it, the great work was born about 4000 BC. That's what they claim in higher Freemasonry. And also in Talmudic Judaism, they also claim the same thing, that was the beginning of this cycle, they call it. So now today it's about 6000 years old. And this is the last phase of it. So, it's a very old plan. What they mean by the light coming down, or the plan coming down from heaven, what it meant was that's when the light dawned, the beginning of the actual plan itself or the great work. And sure enough, that's when you see the heavy outburst of merchandising and gold trading in the ancient Middle East, from Sumer and all over that area. Even though they weighed the gold at that time, I don't think coinage came in until the 80 BC. So they waited, but they used that as a substitute for real wealth. And that was the first con, the first great trick that was ever done, was to make people take that instead of food or barter, you know.
So the development of a currency, one which was metal, was probably the first move. Is that correct?
It was definitely the first move. The entire structural system, even then, which they built up very quickly, enabled them to create cities because then they could hire men. It's very hard to hire men if you have a ton of carrots or vegetables. But if you've trained them to accept money, then you can buy back their labor with that money, you know. And you create the first city. And then the city is artificial. It's the first artificial habitat for humans. And so they must use the money within the city because they don't produce anything themselves. Everything comes into the city to support them. Then you can recruit the army within the city. And once you have the army recruited, you can march out into the rural areas and dominate the people and force them too to use the same money system. And that's what went on and on and on.
Did you ever?
And eventually, of course, they created the first empires. And even the early empires of the Phoenicians were the first free trade zones. And that's what they called them, the free trade zones. Because wherever they went, they introduced the same standardized weighing of, actually it was silver they really started with. And so they had the same weights and measures right up to the present day from the days of Sumer. It hasn't changed with the gram measurements and so on.
Have you ever read a work called The Babylonian Woe?
Oh, yes.
That's. Am I to understand that perhaps either you agree with that information or mined some information from that particular work?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of good information in there. And a lot of the facts were right on. It's how they actually installed their own tyrants into countries. And then the tyrant would start borrowing from the guys who put him in power, which were the bankers, and create the debt system for his country. Then you tax the people, you get them into slavery through taxation.
All right,
so it's a con job, it's all a magic act, as I say. But it works very well, and this worked right up until the present day.
All right, let me recap if I got this straight. If there's a bit of a progression here, you can create the money to stand for value, right?
Yeah.
And then you can build a city, which is an artificial construct, so to speak.
Yep.
And then you can create the army.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking today at what has happened in the 20th century, and can we take it another step? And there may be more steps.
Mm-hmm.
But can we take another step and say, after you've got the money, you got the city, you got the army, mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line, you've also grabbed all means of information so that no one can shed light on what you're doing?
Yeah, because what you do once you accept money, you can then tax the public, and the taxation, the word tax is to labor. That's what it means. You tax yourself
for
your labor. So they take it back from you, so many energy units back from you in the form of taxation. And so you are really working for them. In fact, today in the federal government, I've been told by some people who work there, they see that everyone works for the government. And they do, really. Through all the different taxes that you pay.
Sure, no matter who you work for the government.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's that whole issue here that we talk about in the United States, and maybe it's even true in Canada, I don't know, where we look at ourselves as having, well, some of us do anyway, two citizenships. One is a resident of some geographical thing called the United States,
yeah.
And as employees to the corporation known as the United States of America, Inc.
Yeah.
Going back to earlier times,
mm-hmm.
Are you familiar? Have you ever read any of the work by Philip or Paul Collins?
I think I have. It's a long time ago. Yeah.
Okay. No, it's only because, and they're going to be on shortly also,
mm-hmm.
that they kind of created this continuum. I think that even went back to the Canaanites,
mm-hmm.
through the Phoenicians,
yeah.
and through, the Venetian nobility. And then later on, I guess the Rothschilds and such. Are you in agreement or can you give us some kind of high point in a timeline, with what particular, dynasties or nations really worked this scam to perfection?
Well, I think the scam somehow had been done in what we call a previous time, an age, you might say. And that's a convenient way of categorizing chunks of time. And we know, for instance, and it used to be believed that Sumer was the first civilization.
Mm-hmm.
That was on the go maybe 5,000 BC. and yet it appeared out of nowhere, and it rapidly had to all its different specialized priesthoods. There were bureaucrats and judges and so on. It didn't learn this by itself. It did not evolve that way. It had the information, I think, from a previous age. And then we go into all of the clues that there was a previous time when society had reached a particular height or zenith of power and technology, and some sciences as well. And for some reason, most of it was wiped out. But the knowledge of that system came through again and started off. And now they know, because they've dug up all the Sumerian cities, that there was another culture that pre-existed them, who were also merchants, and they were called, they called them the Hurrians or Harappians. So this goes way back. We don't know how many thousands and thousands of years that this has been understood, but it does seem that the science, for some reason, was partially lost at one point. We all talk about catastrophes on the earth and a new beginning. So I think it's probably a new beginning, with some of them coming through with all of the knowledge of how to re-enslave the people. And that really is what the great work is, really. It's re-establishing something which they dimly refer to as their golden age, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They want to re-establish that. And I think that's what it's all about. I just don't think they evolved anything in Egypt or Sumer. I think probably it's true there were secret brotherhoods who came through from a previous age with the knowledge and the sciences and knew exactly how to reestablish it, even in a more primitive form.
So it's almost like with every civilization or epoch, the same process takes over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also, it's interesting you mention this, because I guess in times gone by, and I'm not necessarily going to identify any religions, whether it was Sumerian or Babylonian or whatever,
mm-hmm.
But the priesthood was necessary in those days because they held a mojo, and it was necessary to corrupt them first, was it not?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Corruption is never a difficult thing if you understand human nature. And I don't think there's any being or subject on the planet that's been more studied than the human being, even many thousands of years ago. And the real eye-opener is to read the writings of the Greek philosophers. And then you realize that when they pulled Freud out the bag, Freud was just he was from kindergarten to what these guys understood about human nature.
Well, you know, we've had people on who have, not so much intimated, but said straight out,
mm-hmm.
they thought that our species was de-evolving.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
De-evolved? Yeah, I know that's a popular theory. And I wouldn't say so as such. I do think...
Okay.
As I say, there probably was a catastrophe, and we find in the writings of Tacitus, who wrote for Nero, he was a historian for Nero, that the Druids in Europe claimed, and Britain claimed, that they had records of previous ages or catastrophes, and how they survived them, and they lived inside high mountains, inside caves. You find that in the writings of the Greek historians. They had Mount Parnassus in Greece. And even if you go to the Armenians that lived at the foot of Mount Ararat,
mm-hmm.
The real ark is inside it. I mean, it's just tunnels, in other words. It's riddled with tunnels, that mountain. And that's where the high priest in those days survived the catastrophe. Those that were left on the surface, I don't think all were wiped out, but after a few generations, they'd gone back to the wild, you might say. And after an amount of time, these priests would pop back out the mountains with all the knowledge, and they came down with the knowledge from the mountains. That's the records of Sumer, in fact. They came out from inside the mountains.
Perhaps, if there's a theme for a third hour, if you'll be so good in time to come to give us a three-parter,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to really run that by about the inside world. I'm not necessarily, and I'll say this prefatorily, that I'm not so much a hollow earth guy, but I think there's a lot of stuff going on underneath.
There always has been, and even today, is underground bases, huge things all over the world. Every country's got them for the leap to go in times of travel. And that's no secret, you know.
I keep thinking it's useless feeders who live on the outside, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. At this point, I do want to give you an opportunity to tell us about how people can access some of the information, especially the series that you write that you refer to as a companion set imprint to go along with the interviews you have done.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what it is and where people can find it and how much it is? And
yeah. Well, the three of them, the writings, I have a cutting through, I call the series, and 1, 2, and 3. The first two mainly go into the ancient Masonic and the modern Masonic codings, because every language we've ever known has had the Masonic codings written through them, and it's used all the time in our face, and we don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
I write the two in a Gestalt-type manner so that the reader doesn't go to sleep when he's reading. And as I say, that's a Western indoctrination technique. We've all been programmed to fall asleep when we just soak up data, you know, and we don't retain it. So I write this in a fashion to keep the person involved as he's writing, as he's reading, and that way he will remember it. The third one is to do with the moneyed system going back for thousands of years, and the writings about the money system from Egyptian and Greek writers, how it came about, who ran it, how they brought the countries down one after another through debt, and who was establishing it, and so on. And it's interesting that even the ancient writers like Aristotle, who basically gave the Christian church his lead, they copied Aristotle's philosophies for centuries. Yet Aristotle, who taught Alexander the Great to be a nice tyrant, Aristotle himself was married to one of the richest bankers in the Middle East. So they're always connected to even the historians. So these books anyway are $25 each. And you can get one or all of them if you send international postal order. I use an international postal order from your post office.
Yeah, don't be sending U.S. postal money orders, right?
Yeah, they can't cash it outside the U.S.
I learned the hard way about that, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
All right, getting back to the task at hand, and you said some interesting things, but, you know, looking back at the money situation, William Still, I don't know if that's a name you're familiar with.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
All right. Still said when he was on, and I referred to the Babylonian woe and that whole money system, and he said, you know, either as to supplant that notion or to expand on it or build on it.
Uh-huh.
He also said it's, you know, let's say it's not so much what you use as value, but that the nation that has it is in charge of creating that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, personally, I think that I don't care who runs money or who decides, or even if the people think initially that they're in charge of it, if they could possibly be, they wouldn't be in charge of it for very long, because
right.
Then that's human nature. So I don't think in a money system, the general population can ever win out. It just can't happen.
Well, in a situation as in the United States, and I'm sure you're familiar with it,
yeah,
we look at a day of ruin. The day that they got through the Federal Reserve and then shortly afterward, the income tax. When the United States government, I guess, performed an unconstitutional act by, extending to another entity that which belonged, that activity that belonged to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, we allowed the Federal Reserve to regulate the value of coin. And I don't know whether or not while you were over in Scotland or in your time now in Canada, did you ever see an event tantamount to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
All right. So did every nation more or less have this event where all of a sudden they became basically enslaved by a taxation mechanism?
Absolutely, yeah.
Now,
I think the income tax in Britain began in 1917. As a temporary war tax.
Ah.
And that
right.
Stayed there, of course, because nothing in that department is ever temporary.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's no taking it back once it happens.
No, no, no. And of course, they're liars anyway, because we're regarded as children. We're sheep. We are really right. The sheep, right. You know. And sheep aren't the brightest creatures on the planet. They're, in fact, they're the stupidest. And the shepherd, the good shepherd, and they've always had a good shepherd in every age, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't come into to see the sheep and scare them. He comes in and he'll talk to them. And some of them might even come up and he'll pat them, you know. They get used to him. He doesn't cull one of them and eat them in front of the rest. Or skin them and use the clothing. He'll coax one out from the rest, out of sight and into it. And that's how you deal with sheep. You never let them know what's really going on. And that's the reality of this parallel government we have, which is worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie Thatcher, gave speeches in the 90s, early 90s, across the world. And the titles of the speech was under the title of the New World Order. And in Massey Hall in Toronto, some novice reporter actually wrote it up in a weekend, and I guess the editor was off because it appeared there, and most of the guests were CFR, which is here, it's Canadian Institute of International Affairs,
right.
Commonwealth country. So, but she said that the next coming war is going to be with the Middle East and fundamental Islam, and they all have to get prepared for it. It was coming. This is around 1991, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew then what was on the cards.
Well, you mentioned two dates,
mm-hmm.
and I can't let them go by or that we pass too far from them without addressing them right now.
Yeah.
That the UK would come in with an income tax very close in time to us.
Yeah.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah. Well, it's the world, isn't it? That's the... That's our sheep world for us, you see. Everything's always a coincidence. And you'd never get the truth out of the big boys. What struck me too is, I mean, during the 60s and 70s and 80s in Britain, actually since the end of World War II, massive layoffs. And, carry on?
Yep.
And, the public were never told why, this was happening. It was absolute chaos. And the suicide rate was incredible because people had no future. And the government went on as usual and didn't say why, of course, because they don't tell the children. And some people suspected what was going on. I certainly did. And I noticed that the language, every year, as delegations went over for the common market, they called it at that time, mm-hmm. the economic market, they would have little phrases in there like cementing closer ties, and this term closer ties came up over and over and over. Then I realized it's a legality, it's a legal term they're using here. They were binding the countries together financially, and if you do it financially, economically, then you do it politically too. And sure enough, once they had united the countries together through deception, It was released only about a year and a half ago from the British Parliament that they read the whole report out that was printed in 1948. That's when they started this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the public must never be allowed to know the real intent and goal of this agenda until it is completed. So here you are. This is rather typical. 40 odd 50 years after the event, you get told the truth.
Well, you know, I go looking back from reading whatever, and they cite, as I asked you, in fact, the other day about where'd you read that, and you said October 30th, Boston Globe, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, thank goodness I can access that stuff. And but even when it's electronic in databases such as LexisNexis, mm-hmm. that may someday disappear, if you know what I mean,
yeah,
and go down the memory hole.
Mm-hmm.
However, thank goodness for microfiche and film and all that other stuff where you can go back and look in past, like, say, foreign affairs.
Yeah.
And then you realize after World War II, there was a great deal of rhetoric about New World Order and stuff. Now, of course, it wasn't in Life magazine or Look magazine.
Yeah.
But these characters were talking about it, and you have mentioned it before on other programs where the think tanks are raised up to create basically policy for all of us globally.
Yeah.
and I go back looking in the 1970s, and I can't remember the author of it, but it was in Foreign Affairs, and the title of it was The Hard Road to a New World Order.
Yeah.
Now, in the 70s, I wasn't paying attention, but when you go back and you look at that, it's like, holy mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing, too, you know, you say Thatcher was talking about the New World Order in 1991, mm-hmm. and by now it's probably known by many,
yeah.
that Daddy Bush's first mention of the New World Order in the United States was 9/11, 1991.
That's right.
And again, we go back to this wonderful numerology that the Freemasonry holds so dear, don't we?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And I'm also thinking about another thing that in the past show, we did a show on a lecture given by an individual by the name of Dr. Anne Marie Slaughter from the Woodrow Wilson School of Government in Princeton. And she wrote a book. It's out there now on Amazon, but she did a lecture on the New World Order. And let me ask you how you feel about this. I mean, because here's what she said. The nation state is alive and well, but it's disaggregating. And what we really need now are international judiciary, legislative, and regulatory agencies. So don't you find, Alan, that it's kind of a doublespeak?
The nation state. Yeah, it's always a doublespeak.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because in the question and answer period, some light bulb in the audience, and this was given in Austin at the University of Texas Law School, and the guy called her out on it. And she kind of, you know, and she said, well, it's only in the thinking stage. Nothing's firm yet. It's as if to say, as long as it's a concept, it doesn't really matter. And it's like, well, it's not going to stay a concept forever.
Yeah.
So what are you telling me, folks? I mean, it's harmless because you're thinking about it.
Yeah. And what you always find, too, is when someone like she was talking about it at that time, whenever they announce it to the public, everything they're talking about is already obsolete. They've gone much, much further. Always.
Mm-hmm.
Always. They're never just going to do something.
No,
they've already done that.
Right.
You know.
And they just soften up the public with a little PR.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like some woman said, I remember hearing on some show, about all the gadgetry and weapons that they have, a lot of bulletless weapons, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, listen, if you hear about it now, it was in R&D 50 years ago.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And of course, we've talked about, you know, are there any such thing as really science fiction writers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One other thing about this, and I want to go back into a little bit of antiquity again with you, and that is I mentioned a white paper that somehow just didn't get on the Hill, and the mainstream news just didn't pick it up, Alan, and it's called Building a North American Community, and the three entities that have contributed to this white paper are the Council on Foreign Relations, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Does that ring a bell?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the Consejo Mexicano de Asuntos Internacionales. So these characters who aren't elected,
yeah.
who knows from under what rock or woodwork they come,
mm-hmm.
and they're making policy, and while they claim that they're not attached to a government within the body of this work, it says, but we want to see this implemented by like 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, if you're not attached to the government, who's going to implement what you guys are cooking up?
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. The governments are just a front. They're just a front. They're a paper tiger.
Why were we given governments? What was the deal with that? Was that really for self-rule, or was that for guys being preoccupied?
Well, found out in the 1700s, there was an age in Europe of rebellion. The public had enough, and there were so many rebellions going on. So they began the Chartist movement to give, and of course they gave the leaders to the Chartist movement, saying we're going to get rights for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that came your so-called democratic system. Prior to that, it was only nobility who had votes in anything. And eventually, about World War One again, the British public actually got the vote, the general working public. And so what they found, if the public thought they could vote, see, we don't vote people in, we vote the present bunch out. We're so sick of them. That's how it works. And so they found that if they give you the chance of someone new every 4 or 5 years, then you don't have a revolution. That's how this game works.
So as we see in the United States right now, and I think this is probably, I mean, it's not that I'm that parochial or myopic about the United States, but I think that people have to be looking at us for all that we supposedly had and are and were or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being given the biggest bag of dog manure,
mm-hmm.
and we don't get it.
No, they don't get it, no.
And so what I'm saying too, I was on a show today, I called in as, you know, as a caller, and I said to this Democratic show, and I like the guys, and they're listening to some 9/11 stuff, but I'm saying, you do a disservice, don't you understand? The Democrats cannot save the country.
Yeah.
You guys, when we have a regime change, just like you said, or we're going to have, let's say Hillary comes in, right? Uh-huh. And then the Democrats, even though she's continuing with the plan, mm-hmm. the Democrats will support that which they castigated when the Republicans were doing it. Mm-hmm. So everybody's sitting there saying that the good old Republicans are dead. We rule the world. We'll do it right. And they'll do the same thing that Shrub did, yeah. that Clinton did, that Daddy Bush did, that Reagan did, that Carter did.
Yeah.
And
that never changes. There's only one agenda, and it goes forward regardless of what front person's in power or appears to be in power. The bureaucracies really have bypassed the politicians since they set up the League of Nations. And it was H.G. Wells talked about that mm-hmm. when it happened, right after World War I. He said the politicians are now irrelevant because that the higher level, bureaucracies can converse straight with their counterparts at the League of Nations. Now it's the United Nations. They don't have to even go through the politicians. And those guys, remember, all these bureaucrats, the federal ones, are unelected. And they're also hereditary positions. Again, that's another thing people don't realize, that you have generations of intergenerational bureaucrats who all are brought up with a silver spoon in their mouth. They all live together, marry each other, and they know what their agenda is in those bureaucracies. They don't care who's apparently in power, you know.
Well, all right, my feeling is this, and please respond.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that Europe, the old world, may have been the old world, but yeah. they were the strong world. And even though the United States became the new world, our freedom was only short-lived. And that really, to this very day, because Europe was out there the first and captured the wealth, that really they still run the show and only let, I think, the United States think it was the top dog because they were very, very willing and generous about using our best blood to go fight European wars and other things.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So they made us feel like we were king.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, bring your troops over. And then, yeah, to me, you know, I'm not talking about British people, right? Mm-hmm. And the Brits just like kind of sat back in a rocking chair and let the Yanks go at it.
Yeah. I think it was Kipling that was in on that changeover, because, there was a poem written about the white man's burden and mm-hmm. we passed the torch on to you. And that was written and read eventually on the U.S. Senate floor by the author. So that was a Masonic meeting on that floor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the word Senate is an Egyptian word. It means a chessboard. Mm-hmm. So when you address that from another country at a Senate level, you are a high-degree Mason.
And so that also was embraced by the Roman Empire, wasn't it?
It was. It's a game, you see, and only the boys on that board, that level, understand the game. And that's what he said, we'll pass the torch on to you, because they'd exhausted the British taxpayers. They had taken them through an industrial revolution where they couldn't even buy the shoes that they were making, you know, as Franklin said. And they've been taxed to the hilt. They've been sent off for perpetual wars ever since the Rothschilds took over the Bank of England. And Britain was exhausted after World War I. So they had to pass it on to the up-and-coming one, the new champion, you see, under a better cover of you know, freedom, etc. Mm-hmm. A country with not a long history. Britain's history was, no one would trust London ever again, or Paris, or any of those old countries.
Yeah.
So they created the United States to take it over. And that's what it did, the shining knight and the white horse. And that was the guise that has come up to the present time. But we're doing it to make the world safe for democracy. You know?
A quick sidebar question, because we are in that season of Happy Saturnalia or Christmas or Xmas, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
If you could give me a response to this, mm-hmm. and that is, would I be correct in assuming, and this is not my idea, Harry, my old partner, and I talk about this, but did Dickens kind of give an elbow and a ribs to the Rothschilds with something like the Christmas story?
Yeah, in a sense he did. However, there's another side to the Rothschilds that's never discussed.
Okay.
And that is, now, the traditional story that people love to use is that the Rothschild sons were sent off to different countries and just took over the central banks by cunning and good luck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the dumb thing. Pray one to believe this. The British aristocracy and nobility came from Norman descent, and they'd already run Britain for over 1,000 years. A thousand and a half years. Or at least 1,000 years. So anyway, they had their own hit teams and assassins and so on. They allowed Rothschild to become the manager of that bank.
Okay.
Because they could have bumped them off at any time, and they would have if it was all real and they truly were enemies, because they were not going to let anybody come in and take over their money.
Well, that's almost like a Chicago gangland scenario from the 20s here, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You move into somebody's territory, you don't give it up, you're going to pay.
You're going to pay. And this lone guy, this fat little guy walking around the narrow streets of London, and he was left unscathed, that tells you that he was protected by the nobility.
Oh, was that old Amschel Bauer?
Yeah, well, Amschel was the father.
Okay, and this was what, Nathan?
Yeah, Nathan.
Okay.
Rothschild, yeah. So that's the thing. I mean, he was left alone. I think he was brought in for his purpose by the nobility and the aristocracy. I
want to remind everybody that you're listening to The Grassy Knoll. This is Viz with Alan Watt. Alan has a Cutting Through series, three parts. Again, would you tell us which of the three parts relates to what particular topic?
Yeah, well, the first two, one and two, go through Freemasonry and a few things which I've never really ever thought about. I go through how they literally created the English language to contain all of their codings, and they created it in the 1500s, and Francis Bacon talked about the creation of the English language. And the third one goes into the money system, the control technique of creating debt in countries, and then putting your own boys in charge of those countries to manage the debt under the guise of governments and so on.
I'm just curious, if you don't mind me asking. I'm not really familiar where Astaire is. Where are you? What's in the closest city you're located in?
It's near Sudbury.
Okay, okay.
Near Sudbury, North Ontario. Well, not really north, it's midway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wayne Gretzky owns the hockey team there, but that's another thing.
Yeah.
All right, going back to the history, I'm going to ask you one, too. There was an organization I found that had very little light shown on it in England. It was an Anglo-American relationship. Mm-hmm. Quigley gave up a lot about Rhodes and Milner, mm-hmm. but said nothing about the Pilgrim Society. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yes, yeah.
What is the deal with the Pilgrim Society? I mean,
there's a long connection here with this mystery bunch and mystery religion and the United States. Going back to the foundation of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even a play on the word Puritan, because many of the Puritans, when you really go into it, had a little bit more than religion, and they were extremely wealthy. They had their own charter of democracy, by the way. It was democracy they had on their ship. They had put together themselves, supposedly. And they even had a structural system where they would divvy up land when they landed and run it in a communal fashion, almost like a mini-government, a mini-democracy. And they had scandals which broke out after the headman died. I saw a book from the 1800s recently, in fact, in an old bookstore, going into this and how he legally and through devious means managed to take money from so many of them and property without them even knowing, but he did it all through various legal means.
Right.
But so I wasn't surprised there. But yeah, there's been a tie between the mystery religions, you might say, and the ones who claim to be pure, you know.
Well, Charles Savoy wrote about this. It's the first time I encountered it, and he did a three-part series on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he referenced the books which he read, and I got them through interlibrary loan. Two of them were written by a member. The third and the latest was written probably as an authorized biography, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But they have in the back all the meetings that they have. And usually they, you know, they have a guest and who that should be, and it was Kissinger and this one and that one. Uh-huh. And then all, and they tell you where it was, and but then there's some that just says the end of the middle chord.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what's the end of the middle chord?
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, that sounds interesting. And they say not much about it. No guests of honor or anything, just end of the middle chord.
Right.
And this reflects back to what you said about the City of London.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if I look around at probably the two biggest networks, I think, that run the show, the City of London, is that to be distinguished from London?
It is really, yeah. It's got its own charter. Uh-huh.
And also, I think, the Vatican. But the City of London, that's a very interesting situation, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's almost a sovereign, really a sovereign state within that country.
As is the Vatican, true?
Yeah.
And do we think that... And are we right in assuming that the royals never really did fade away? They may have stepped back, and like you said, all right, let's have this government thing going. Go ahead, guys. I'll see you later on.
Mm-hmm.
But are they poised in most of the nations of Europe to step up one day and wish the reinstitution of this time a new feudalism?
It's already happened in a sense. The new feudalism, as Carla Quigley said, would be based, the new feudal overlords would be multi and international corporations who would then be dictating policy. Well, they are, as we know. They are, through, because they all have front groups of NGOs, and they fund these front groups who then put pressure, or the apparent pressure for public consumption, onto the government to then quite happily sign the various laws that they want enacted. So the international corporations are already doing this. They have been doing it for many years, in fact. And Carl Quigley was pretty explicit about that would be the new form, again, economic tyranny run by the overlords, which are international corporations. To be honest with you, I really don't think we have separate international corporations. That's how far I go with all of this. I think they're all one anyway.
Well, I agree, but can you be a little bit more explicit in developing what you just said? When you talk about international corporations as being all one, mm-hmm. can you give us some kind of example?
It's common sense. I always think of Albert Pike, who gives you the laws and the rules of this Masonic game. And he said that a person who will not use their own powers of reason, not the media's or what you're told, but your own powers of reason, he said, is nothing more than meat on the table and a beast of burden by choice and consent. And so my reason tells me that if you had two or three major car corporations, for an example, and the CEO can leave one and go to another, a supposed competitor, and take all of the future plans with him, obviously, then you'd have chaos in those markets. And you could never allow them to even leave, because those guys make business plans for 50 or 100 years ahead in investments.
Well,
so how on earth could the top man leave knowing all this stuff and go to a competitor? It would fall apart. Mm-hmm. There'd be warfare amongst them.
So in a sense, we have a global monopoly.
Yes, we have it right now. And that's what I've known for many years, that really everything is one, as they're always telling us. They're all one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one system. You don't get up to the top in anything because you work hard and you're lucky and you get the breaks. You only get up to the top if they open the door and let you in. That's how the real system works. And it's like Bill Gates. I mean, he deals with the computer industry, so he's the Masonic gatekeeper mm-hmm. of information. You have your Apple computers. Apple is what? That's knowledge, the tree of knowledge, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Takes the Apple. The best Apple is a Macintosh. You know, I mean, this is all Masonic, you know, wording.
Uh-huh. Oh, you mean it's just not a coincidence, huh?
Oh, no. It's playing jokes with us all the time.
Yep. And one other thing I have to tell you, we're going to probably run out of time, and I want to run by your information again. I know I can't see an email. I know what your situation is. But in that Pilgrim, one of the three Pilgrim books, mm-hmm. you would love it. There's Harry Truman with a grin from ear to ear. As you know, Harry Truman could smile.
Yeah.
And he's glad-handing somebody from the Pilgrim Society. It was not somebody like a king or a prince or whatever, but... And the Masonic grip is just so in your face. It's like the joke is on us, guys. You know what I mean? You'd love it. I got to somehow, some way get you that facsimile. I keep threatening to put up a whole series of what we would call They Know the Handshake up on the site. We've been talking to Alan Watt out of Canada, and he's a frequent guest on Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty and a couple other places. And you can look around and do a search on him. You'll find out what he's about and hear other interviews he's given. We hope he'll come back for two more with us. He has written a series called The Cutting Through Series. It's three parts. It is accessible for $75, obviously, for the whole ball of wax. We're going to leave you now. And if you would, I would ask you if you could. I'll tell you what, I'll cut you free, but if you don't mind, I'm going to give you a call back. We can make some arrangements for future shows.
Yeah.
I hope you've enjoyed your time here. Obviously, I'm very, very encouraged to have heard so much about you, and that the fact is that you're the real deal. And we thank you, and of course, we'd like to have you come on again. This is Alan Watt. I'm Biz. This is the Grassy Knoll, and we'll catch you in another week. Good night.
Yeah.